Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Podcast Network, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, we take a look back at some of our top episodes of 2024 from both of our podcast series, AWM Author Talks and Nation of Writers. This is our final episode of 2024. We'll return next year with even more episodes featuring the writers you love and the stories they tell. Presented in order of release date, we hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer. First up, from AWM Author Talks, pop culture historian Jennifer Keeshan Armstrong discusses her book, So Fetch, The Making of Mean Girls, and why we're still so obsessed with it.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I love about it is that it's very, very, very funny, first of all. I think that's actually really important. We hadn't had this kind of like edgy, funny movie for teen girls before. If you and it let its girls be all these different kinds of girls and be terrible. And I think that's really important too. We had not, if you think of like the closest thing before is like Clueless, it's a pretty cuddly movie. Like, I mean, Cher is the sweetest little kitten you've ever seen. She just happens to be rich too, but we love her, right?
I mean, they have problems, but they're not hurting each other in irreparable ways.
I mean, she has like a little scuffle, you know, with her friends, but like, it's not, she's not, nobody's really that terrible. I know Paul Rudd lectures her a lot in that movie, but like, she's actually doing pretty well. Whereas like every single one of the main girls in this does something terrible at one point or another. You know, Katie has blood on her hands. Regina's terrible, but at least she's honest about it. You know, I mean, Janice might be the worst, and I love her, but she might be the worst. And so I think it showed that it took its audience seriously, which is young women, by being this bold and funny and giving them a movie. Like, I mean, it's funny because like the Blues Brothers thing, even there's these movies like Blues Brothers and Caddyshack and Ghostbusters that guys always had to have the little like quotable one-liners and all of that. And Mean Girls really brought that for girls. And I think that that's actually significant, that this really is showing, like, I'm going to be super entertaining and beautiful and funny as a movie, but it still can be powerful, I think, and empowering. And I really think that's a huge reason why millennial girls and really a lot of millennial gay men hooked into this so strongly.
Next up on Nation of Writers, learn about the life and legacy of former U.S. Poet Laureate W.S. Merwin. In this clip, you'll hear from Sonnet Coggins, Executive Director of the Merwin Conservancy, a thriving arts and ecological organization on the island of Maui, where Merwin lived.
How do you think the gardening and the palms and creating that land helped to inspire his poetry and his work?
One of the many ways I think I could answer that ties in some ways to a real shift in his poetry from the moment that he dropped all punctuation from his work. And also that his work turned more from, you know, the incredible anguish he felt about human exceptionalism, about extinction, about extraction, to that notion that pulled him to this place to begin with when he saw that note of nothing will grow here is, how could I enact my care for the world as a way of sort of coping amidst all of this? And so this impulse, I think, took shape in his daily tree planting and in his the writing that was even done here. In an incredibly ritualized day. And you know, I remark on this all the time. It was very disciplined and very routine, but not at all like a rut. It was very much animated by a ritual, a mindful ritual. So in the house that he built on the land well before the garden came up around it, he would wake up every morning and meditate in the garden dojo, in the dojo in the house, the meditation space in the house for 45 minutes. And then he would go on to the breakfast lanai, he called it, and have tea and write, or in his study and write all morning. And as we've heard from Paula and others, no one could speak to him before noon because this was his time set aside to really concentrate on his craft of writing. And then he, in the afternoon, spent the whole day in the garden. And I think, you know, when I first started working here, there were some people who said, wow, you have a big charge. How will you reconcile this botanic mission with the literary mission? And really, you know, to speak to your question, I think what it was is this impulse underneath both of those of wonder and of attention and of imagination that either took form in a garden or took form in a poem. So it's that undercurrent of presence and attention to the world around him that gave form to the garden and to a lot of the writing he did while living here for 40 years.
Next up, also on Nation of Writers, bestselling author R.O. Kwan discusses the impact of Audre Lorde, a self-described Black lesbian mother warrior poet, on her life and writing.
And I think a lot about that when it comes to just how impossible it feels to really shake off the shame and the guilt and the anxiety around talking about desire, let alone queer desire, let alone queer kinky desire. And I'm just like, you know, I think a lot of my ancestors were, I seem to feel almost like a, I hear like shouting inside my body, and the shouting says things like, what are you doing? You're going to get yourself killed. And those messages are really just, our ancestral lessons that are just hanging out in my body, trying to keep me safe. Yeah. I keep trying to tell that part of my body and my mind, you know, I don't think I'm going to get killed for having written a novel. It's a novel, for heaven's sake.
Yeah.
but I can't convince myself. And so while writing this book, I did, it helped a lot to just keep revisiting the work of writers who also talked openly about being afraid of what they were saying, about being afraid of what they were putting into the world. And Audre Lorde is one of these people because she, you know, she talks about just like, yeah, this is sometimes really scary. And I'm going to do it anyway. And I find that to be useful because if I can't really talk down the anxiety and I can't really talk down what really amounts at some points to terror. I can do the thing anyway, though, and that feels useful.
Up next on AWM Author Talks, actor, playwright, and director J. Nicole Brooks discusses the lasting influence of Lorraine Hansberry.
I'm still ruminating on your first question. How does this still influence you today?
Yeah.
I mean, just again, I know everyone's like, everyone always talks about a raisin in the sun, but for me, it just kind of like, it popcorned out so many things. So again, go back to when I'm an 11-year-old child, I'm rewatching this film every Saturday. And that's how I learned who Diana Sands was. That's, you know what I mean? And then that's where, I remember one day, I was watching it and my mom was like, oh, look at little Glenn Thurman. I was like, wait, ooh, that's yeah. right?
right.
And so
right.
I'm like, wait, that's Preach from Cooley High? And so like, you know.
You mean the Colonel from Different World.
Right. But for me, that was like, cause Cooley High was the other movie that I watched like all the time. But back to Diana Sands for just a moment. Diana Sands, because of this, her relationship, of course, they were friends, she and Lorraine Hansberry. And she also died very young, tragically, of cancer. And there was a film that Diana Sands was supposed to star in called Claudine. Mm. And Claudine was, you all know it as Diane Carroll giving a gorgeous performance, but she did it because Diana Sands became sick with cancer and wasn't able to do it. So for me, Lorraine Hansberry opened up this portal, I suppose you could call it, for me as a very young person. And this is the influence that made me go, hey, I want to direct. Ooh, I want to write. Ooh, I want to act. What if I want to do all of them? I can. And it's because of the audacity of somebody that I've never met. And it's really, frankly, crazy to me. I mean, you can think whatever you want to about statues or not, but like, my goodness, I think it is. I'm so grateful for this Lorraine Hansberry initiative and what we're doing. And shout out to the Lilies. I mean, I think it is absolutely that Black femme writers and women are just still underrecognized. So the influence is like, yeah, it's here. And I just love the way it's spreading.
Up next, from Nation of Writers, scholars and writers Ana Louise Keating and Irena Lara Silva discuss the life and legacy of work from queer Chicana poet, essayist, and theorist Gloria E. Anzaldúa.
But I think she was really aware of how important she was to young Chicanas. And I think that she would, it seems to me, she would clearly like heighten that part of herself when it would be useful for her audience, right?
Because, I mean, yeah. One of the big things in terms of identity, one of the things that was immense for me, but that I think is still immensely impactful on people who are reading the work now for the first time, is her strong identification with indigeneity. Because it has been for so long shamed out of people and denied. And that hits in such a strong way because it gives us a different way of belonging. As a Latina, as a Chicana, as a Mexican-American Tejana writer, I end up on a lot of panels with other writers who identify as Latina or Hispanic or Chicana or Tejana, whatever they identify as. And it's always fascinating to me that not just in the, you know, in mainstream culture, but even within our own circles, that everyone assumes that if we identify as Latina in any way, that we are either immigrants or first generation. I am not. I am probably I'm probably a combination of third, fifth, seventh Mexican generation, sixth Spanish generation, and then a whole bunch of indigenous from both sides of the border. And it gives us a different way, I think, of looking at identity if we identify as indigenous across national lines. I remember I was in a panel and I said, you know, I have as much right as anyone else to say who belongs here, you know, and if I say they are my cousins, they are my cousins because indigenously they are all my cousins on both sides. And so it starts to give us a different way of looking at things globally. And I'm pretty sure all of that, to me, came from Anzaldúa, not from my family, who was trying to deny all indigeneity mm-hmm. and African roots. But that's, you know, that's a very strong and powerful influence that Anzaldúa had and has on people.
And of course, what she's being criticized for among some. But I agree with you. She, early on, when her own family was denying the indigenous or any African ancestry, she was clear like, hey, this is us too. We are this. And so there's that. Then I think when she read indigenous philosophy as well as Western esoteric, like she could see her ideas and sense of things and connection with the land reflected back to her in ways that affirmed for her. So I think that was all really important. And then I think also she had if we think of her like metaphysics, she had that, it's kind of a monism, but it's a very multiplicitous monism, seeing spirit in everything. If you see spirit in everything, you're not going to go around setting up borders saying you can only identify as this, you can only identify as that, you can only connect here. That doesn't work if you are seeing some kind of radical, profound, complex, differential interconnectedness, right? So it gave her a kind of boldness that kind of ends up flying in the face of many different versions of identity politics, and that clearly people still find are really uncomfortable with.
Next up on AWM Author Talks, Acclaimed mystery novelist and free speech advocate Sarah Paretsky discusses the perils of book banning from the Freedom to Read panel at the 2024 American Writers Festival.
When I was doing research for this talk, I came on a book called Books on Fire by a French historian named Lucien Polastron. It was a fascinating history in a hideous sort of way because it detailed the vast numbers of books and scrolls and papyri that have been burned in the brief 5,000 years of the written word. Faced with many millions of books destroyed in the Second World War alone, some writers, Polastron quotes, threw up their hands in despair. What was the point of writing anything, of adding to the world's philosophy or poetry or stories, if their words had no effect on public behavior, if books were still burned, if people were still massacred by the millions? These writers felt so helpless that they retreated behind a self-created wall of silence. Well, I have the opposite reaction. I think that the passion books inflame is proof that they are doing their job and that we writers are doing our job. Stalin sent the poets Mandelstam and Tsvetaeva to die in the gulags because of the power of their words in the Russian imagination. Writers besides Michael Servetus who've been burned for their words include Rabbi Akiba, burned by the Romans in 137 Jerusalem, with the scrolls of that most dangerous book, the Torah, around him. My personal icon among people murdered by fire is Joan of Arc. She wasn't a writer. She was illiterate, and her illiteracy paradoxically contributed to her death. Noble-born women of her era had visions similar to hers, but their status made authorities think their visions were safe. An illiterate peasant threatened the social order. I came to Joan as a 10-year-old. I came to her through a book. My parents worried that my intense personality would make my adult life turbulent and difficult, and they were right. They gave me Mark Twain's personal recollections of Joan of Arc to warn me of the fate that awaited girls who took life too intensely. Unfortunately, the book had kind of a kickback effect on me. It made me long for a vision as intense as Joan's, one that I might follow to the stake. Even now, in my older age, that is still the longing that guides me. 2,600 years ago, the poet Sappho wrote, "Although they are only breath, words which I command are immortal." That word, which is only breath, has survived countless wars, fires, murders, mutilations. That word will endure, it will triumph, but only if those of us in this room, those of us who have dedicated our lives to this word, stand strong. For myself, I pray that in the turbulent days that are surely coming, I keep my own shape aligned with Joan's, that I don't let fear silence me. I pray that she will help me face and fight the monsters that threaten to devour us.
Next up, also on AWM Author Talks, the Level Up Writing and Gaming panel from the 2024 American Writers Festival, featuring game writers and designers Keith Amon, Derek Tyler Attico, Keisha Howard, Carla A. Kokurek, and Samantha Ortez, presented in conjunction with our current special exhibit, Level Up, Writers and Gamers.
As a kid, I was an avid book reader. Like, that was my escapism. That was, like, my me time. That was everything to me. That's how I learned. And that was in the 80s, right, when I first started developing those formative experiences. So when video games were, you know, first came out for me and I experienced that immersion between play and visuals and storytelling that really sort of expanded how I thought about my identity even, or, you know, just what could exist, the possibilities that were out there. So that's what gaming and writing really mean. It was absolutely a formative experience.
I think for me, it was playing role-playing games. And when I first started playing role-playing games, I said, I said to myself, well, not only do I want to play, I want to learn how to construct that. And to do that, you have to write, of course. So that's how I got into it.
Yeah, in role-playing gaming, I mean, I think everyone who gets into that hobby gets into it because they want to be the authors of their own stories. They want to create characters and tell the stories of those characters. They want to create settings and environments and worlds if they're the game masters, and they want to populate that with people and creatures which have their own stories and that the player characters will interact with. And so it's all storytelling, top to bottom. And when you start publishing things for people outside your own group, then, you know, then you're writing it down, because that's how you transmit that knowledge.
Yeah, everyone said it really well, but yeah, just all games have story. All games, the games that you don't think have story because they're very mechanic heavy, there's a story behind it. Everything has lore. Yeah, and the more that you work with it and break it down, it's really rewarding.
Up next on Nation of Writers, author and activist Jen Soriano discusses the legacy of Colonel Ye Panyilio, a Filipina-American journalist and guerrilla army leader during World War II.
I think one of the main things that I got from reading Panyilio is more courage. You know, I had said that I was looking for examples of other Filipina-American authors who were writing personal stories. And, you know, she shares so much about her life and how hard it was, as you can imagine, during a war, being a guerrilla fighter at that time, being a woman in a whole regiment of men. And so whenever I was writing my book and I got a little bit squeamish about telling truths about my own family or about myself, I would just think about her experiences and, you know, how she'd survived near starvation, was walking in the middle of the night across mountains to evade Japanese detection while having malaria, things like that. And I was like, you know what? If she could survive that and live to write about it, I can write about my relationship with my mother. You know what I mean? And so that example of, I think, feminist bravery was really important for me. And surprisingly, another thing that I got from it was the reminder to use humor and how important humor is in writing. Even when you're writing about really heavy subjects, like in my case, transgenerational trauma, and in her case, war. One of my favorite things about this book is that she writes in a way that brings you, it's the opposite of bird's eye, a ground level view of what day-to-day life was like for guerrilla fighters. And as you can imagine, there's quite a bit of intense and terrible things that she describes. But at the same time, she describes this kind of ebb and flow between vigilance and patrolling, and then joking and playing pranks on other soldiers. And, you know, later I can share a couple of my favorite quotes that actually are about humor. But basically, you know, being reminded that, especially in the hardest of times, humor is a tool of resilience was important to my writing. And so I actually went back and revised a specific essay in my book that's called 381 Years, which is about the 381 years that the Philippines was subject to colonization by the Spaniards and then by the Japanese, the United States and the Japanese. And I revised that essay to have a whole section that was specifically about humor and how throughout the resistance to erasure and division that Filipinos always retained their sense of humor, and not only retained it, but actually really used it as a tool of resistance and resilience. And that is present throughout Panlilio's book.
Up next, also from Nation of Writers, New York Times bestselling author Stephen Graham Jones discusses the influence of novelist James Welch on his own writing and Native literature at large.
You know, you asked earlier, the first time I read Winter in Their Blood, what did I get from it? I think that's probably what I got from it was the humor, was the permission to actually be funny on the page, you know? Because writing programs don't really support comic stuff very well. You know, they want you to be serious and dour. And if it makes somebody laugh, then that's not, you know, we need to do intellectual things, please, you know? Welch did not care about that. He had a good sense of humor, definitely. And I kind of took the humor from Winter in the Blood as my I don't know, threshold or something for, I mean, if something is, I guess, A, good and B, Indian, you know. People are always trying to figure out what makes a novel Indian and what's the like point at which it stops being Indian, and who knows where. I mean, that line is ridiculous to try to figure out, because first you have to define Indian, and how in the world do you define that? But my own like litmus test is, if I'm reading a piece set on a reservation or wherever, or with an Indian community or Indian characters, and people aren't you know, cracking jokes, being funny, undercutting things with grins and everything, then I know this was probably not written by somebody who knows the community, knows the people, knows the way life is, you know? And which is to say, they treat everything as sacred. And I don't know. I mean, that's the response I despise the most to native literature is, oh, we got to put on our special gloves now, because this is really exotic, sacred material, you know? And it's not, it's just stories. And we're just poking fun at things and having a good time, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's another, that kind of makes me think of another quote of Welch's I found was in a 1985 interview. He says, "I used to be able to say that I'm an Indian who writes, and I still say that, but more and more my subject matter has been Indians. I seem to be becoming more and more of an Indian writer." and then at the same time, he, you know, resisted that categorization and he said, "I think ethnic and regional labels are insulting to writers and really put restrictions on them. People don't think your work is quite as universal."
Mm-hmm. No, I totally agree. I always feel like anytime you let the critical establishment, the marketplace, whoever, put an adjective in front of your name, like Indian or I don't know, splatterpunk or romance or anything, then that adjective in front of your name serves as a handle they can use to lift you up, put you in a little cubbyhole and forget about you. You get to get rid of you, basically. So I think that's one thing I learned from Welch. I learned it from Louise Erdrich. I learned it from Jill Lansdale, is resist that categorization with every chance you get, resist it. The only one that I allow that I'm not sad about when I see it in front of my name is New York Times bestseller. I think that's a good one. But the rest of them, I always try to kick, you know, I just want to be a writer. And yeah, like Welch, I'm just a writer who happens to be Indian, you know?
And finally, just released earlier this month, Mike Thomas, co-author of the definitive Johnny Carson biography, Carson the Magnificent, sits down with Rick Kogan of the Chicago Tribune to discuss the book and Carson's legacy.
How do you figure that Johnny Carson, who stopped doing The Tonight Show more than 30 years ago, and after that was barely a ghost in the firmament, what do you make of that? I mean, the thing is, it is still true, I think, in this town, specifically of Royko, who's been gone for more than 30 years, and his play is sold out, and people, what's the magic there, Mike?
I mean, I think there's an emotional connection with Johnny that there is very rare, especially with people of a certain age, you know, boomers, Gen Xers, and, you know, the clips still play online. They still play on antenna TV, and Johnny's still swirling. I don't know that he's at the forefront of,
well, I don't know, but yeah,
younger people's minds.
I don't believe that the clips that, but I have not heard anybody in as long as I can remember greet me in the morning by saying, "Hey, I just watched a really funny thing called about Carnac. Do you know who that was?" I go, "Yeah, I do, but how would you?"
I agree.
I suppose it's part of the intimacy of watching television while you're in bed and reading a newspaper while you're having a cup of coffee. I am not sure that can be replicated these days. You?
No, I don't think so. That there was that communal experience. You know, he had at one point in the late 70s, early 80s, 17 million people watching him at the same time every night. No DVRs, no streaming. You know, it was a lot of them were in bed. As Bill writes, he was the last face that flickered on their brain before they went to sleep. And like I said, they developed this emotional connection with him. And also, Johnny runs through everybody who's in late night now. He, of course, was, you know, Letterman's mentor.
Sure.
And Letterman had a very different sensibility, but even to this day, he'll tell you Johnny was the greatest of all time. But he's in Letterman, he's in Kimmel, he's in Colbert, he's in Conan, another Johnny acolyte. Yeah. It may not be apparent to people, but there are bits and pieces, vestiges of Johnny in all of these people who came after him.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. This is our final episode of 2024. We'll return next year with even more episodes featuring the writers you love and the stories they tell. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.